Standing out. Can we see this at all? Okay. We're going to look at the life of Abraham today, or continue looking at it. We're going to be looking at the story of Genesis chapter 14. It involves five kings around Abraham's area, around Sodom and Gomorrah, south of the Dead Sea, and an invasion of four kings from the east, Chedorlaomer and his group coming over and attacking Sodom and Gomorrah. In that time, we're going to see that Lot has gone into the city. Last time we left him, he camped near the city. He's gone into the city now, is part of the culture, and he himself is taken captive with the plunder and is headed back to the Middle East, or headed back to the land between the rivers, Mesopotamia. And at that time, Abram hears about it, and he goes out with his trained men, his own military that lives in his household, and attacks these four kings, these four victorious kings from the east, and brings back Lot, all the people that were taken captive, and all of the plunder. As he returns, he meets Melchizedek, the priest and king of Salem, which is the city of Jerusalem, and he has an encounter there with the king of Sodom and the king Melchizedek. So actually, you've got four kings from the east, five kings from Sodom and Gomorrah, that's nine kings. Then he's going to meet Melchizedek, the tenth king, and Melchizedek, in a sense, is going to welcome Abram himself as a king and treat him as a king. In that case, he almost himself becomes a king. Some of the things we're going to see during this discussion. One, we've talked a lot about in the past about the cycles of discipline a culture goes through, laid out in the Law of Moses. We see it repeated in Scripture, and this is a classic case of it. Sodom and Gomorrah are living outside of God's will. That's clear in Scripture. They're living, they've broken down certain societal standards, certain things that God established for mankind to live by. God leads into the destruction or overthrow of a culture, not in a moment. He doesn't just in a moment of rage destroy something. He gives them warnings. He gives them signs. His idea from if it be in the church, if it be in the Old Testament, throughout history, God's plan is that men repent, that men come to Him. And He'll give, we saw Him talk to Cain, how patient He was working with Cain. He could have just zapped him, but instead, hey, Cain, consider your ways. And talked with him and spoke and tried to lead him into righteousness. God does the same thing with cultures. As we look at this right here, we can realize that earlier chapter, we saw that there had been a famine in the land and Abram had to leave. That's a warning sign. Economic disaster, it's a warning sign things are going wrong, something's happening. In this case, the fourth cycle of discipline is going to come upon these people. Well, let's go back to this. The third cycle involves foreign occupation. Foreign occupation, and in this case, the fourth cycle, where your culture is actually taken captive. You're taken out of the land. That's what happens here. They're overrun. With the fifth cycle actually being the destruction of your culture. And that's coming with the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah with fire and brimstone. So we see here, without going through the whole teaching of the overthrow of a culture, we see right here that pattern just taking place right up until the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Another thing we're going to see is the character of Abram and the ability to stand in the ways of God in the midst of opposition, of cultural difference. That's where we're at. I think that's where every Christian is, wherever they lived in history. Lot is an example of someone who just simply succumbed to the way of the culture. Had no defenses. He saw the good land, went near the good land, lived among the good land, and eventually is in the city, and his problems are just beginning. Also want to mention, as we look at this, Lot is losing things. That the further he gets, the more he loses. Or the closer he gets, the more he loses. Abraham is eventually going to say to the king of Sodom, I don't even want your stuff. I don't want anything that you've got. In other words, my prosperity is not tied into your economy. My prosperity is in following God. Lot didn't understand that. Last week we saw him move toward, he go, hey, My prosperity is tied into the good land. I'm going to go down here by Sodom and Gomorrah. Then he's living in Sodom and Gomorrah and is taken captive. Soon it's going to be overthrown. He's going to end up in a cave. Wealthy Lot, the heir of all of Terah's wealth, the nephew of Abram himself, is going to end up losing everything because he tried to tie his prosperity, his success, into the world instead of just trusting God and doing what was right. In the end, he lost everything and ends up in a cave. Meanwhile, Abram is still prospering and doing God's will in the land. Another thing we're going to see besides the honor of being able to stand against opposition is of keeping covenants and being faithful. Personally, if I'm Abram, and this happens to Lot, now again, I'm not talking as an outstanding righteous Christian. I'm righteous in Christ, but still renewing my mind. If Lot is taken captive, it's like, he deserved it. Good luck. I'm staying with God. You're just going to get your... But Abram is, I would say, a better example than me. Abram hears about this, and instantly the Hebrew word says he poured out his troops, poured them out. He goes to rescue Lot. He is faithful to his covenant. He is faithful to his family in that sense, and goes out and rescues Lot. Risks his own wealth, his own power, his own position, his own life for Lot, who is clearly walking in the ways of the world. That's a good example of being faithful. Another thing we see, Abram, towards the end of this, I'm telling all these things right now because once I get into the story, I may forget to point them all out, is Abram demonstrates how to avoid entanglements in materialism. When he comes back down through and meets the king of Salem and the king of Sodom, he knows enough to keep himself there. There's torment. He has just returned or restored the plunder of, well, I'll show you the cities here in just a minute, of an area. I would say they're little kingdom states or little kingdom cities. Oh, you know, maybe 25 cities that have been conquered by these kings. And they've got all the plunder and all the people. They're heading back to the east. And Abram goes up and takes it all from them and brings it back down in the promised land. And he now controls the wealth of every city conquered by those kings of the east. Is in his control. I tell you what, I've never been faced with that kind of a temptation. I now control all of this wealth. And Abram, in one simple statement, says, I don't even want tied to it. Take it. Look what it's doing to you guys. I don't want anything to do with it. And walk. Now, Abram, if we know, and we're going to see again today, is not a poor man. Abram is not living, in some little pup tent somewhere with one camel out back tied to a stick with a wife who's trying to figure out what we're going to make for dinner. Abram has got an entire community. He's a sheik. He has tremendous wealth. But if he was after wealth, he would have said, there must be some way to justify keeping this because God's blessed me with it. Instead, he said, I'm not after wealth. I want nothing to do. I don't want to get entangled in this. Take the stuff. And did not allow himself to get entangled in materialism. Another thing he did not do when the king of Sodom says, you keep the wealth. I just want the people, which was in a sense an agreement, a treaty, a recognition. The king of Sodom wanted Abram to recognize him as the king, as the sovereign. In those days, what was common was when a warrior or a group of people that were defending a city would go out and get the plunder back for a city that had been taken captive, they would then receive the plunder they recovered. They'd get to keep it, but they would then recognize the king that they took it for as the king and then submit themselves back to him, but they got to keep what they recovered. Abram says, I'm not going to recognize you as any king. Take your stuff, take your people. I want no alliance with you. Lot himself doesn't even have enough sense to leave the city. Lot moves back into the city and waits for the fifth cycle of destruction to come, which is the complete overthrow or burning up of the city. If Lot was paying attention, he would have said, I see a pattern here. My life is deteriorating. My prosperity, my possessions, it's deteriorating. This city is living in immorality. This is a corrupt culture. And we just keep getting worse and worse, not just in our behavior, but in the reactions we get from God. Maybe I should go somewhere else. But instead, moves back into the city, takes his family back in the city, and just continues riding out the decline. And the last thing I want to mention as we get to the end of this chapter, if we hurry, is when Abram says, I don't want any of your stuff. He's got three friends with him. Mamre, Aner, and Eshcol. They're the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites living there with him. They have some kind of an agreement with him. He's eventually going to, he lives among them. And they go with him. They support him in his endeavor. And when Abram says, I don't want any of this stuff, I don't want to get entangled in this, he doesn't take that conviction and say, and neither does Mamre, Aner, and Eshcol, they don't want anything either, do you guys? He says, as for me, I've taken a vow to God. This is my relationship with God. That's what I'm going to do. But for these guys, they'll take their share. but I'm not gonna take it. We have a tendency to take our personal conviction. Now understand what I'm talking about. There is righteousness and there's absolutes. But when you take a stand for God, say, this is how I'm going to live my life, that does not mean your job now is to get everybody else to make the same conviction. They have their own level of conviction. And he says, I'm not going to do it. He says, my men that fought with me, you need to provide for their food. You're going to pay for their food that they ate and what they drank. You're going to pay for the war. Little lesson right there. You're going to pay for the war. I'll fight it, but you'll pay for it. Yeah, we'll leave it right there. You'll pay for the war that I fought for you. You'll pay for my men's food and drink, what they needed. I am not going to take anything from it, but my allies, they'll make their own choice. He was not what we'd say self-righteous and imposing his standard of righteousness on everybody else. Well, let's go here with the maps. Chapter 14. 6 maps in one chapter. A lot of cities, a lot of traveling. Every one of these cities is in, I hope you like them. I hope you can read them. Do the best you can with them. Make your own if you want to. Every one of these cities that we talk about is in this chapter. The reason we're going to go through it real quickly so we don't have to stop each time and point out where those cities are. But first of all, you've got on the right side of that first map, you see down there on the bottom of the, if you hold it like this, you can see there's a 1 down there. That means page 1. It means there's a page 2 coming. On the right side of the map, over there by the Euphrates River, you can see the kings right there, the 5 kings and where they're located. And it got the names of the lands, Elam, Shinar, Goyim, the king of Goyim, which means nations. They're going to come down. We're going to give you more details here in a minute. They're going to come down from the east, probably passing through Haran, going through Damascus in the area just north of the Sea of Galilee, and past where Dan is going to be. That's the way into the land. They're going to come down the right side of, or the east side of the Jordan River, and they're going to attack the 5 kings. They've got 5 dots there for the 5 cities, Sodom and Gomorrah and Zoar and the other ones, and then little crowns for each of the 5 kings. Okay, so 4 kings from the east coming in on 5 kings. Notice those 5 kings are all situated down south of the Dead Sea. Turn the page. Number 2. Here is the approach of the kings coming through. They're going to mention these cities right here. As they approach, this road is very easy to identify. This is clearly where they came. This city, the locations are identifiable. The route is accurate. They're traveling on the east side of the Jordan through the mountain ranges, coming through the mountain areas there, and just hitting these cities. They're going to go all the way past, see Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, Zoar, Zeboiim right there. They're going to go past them on the east and head down to the hill country of Seir, which is Edom. They're going to encircle them. Turn the page 3. Once they hit Seir, or the hill country of Edom, they're going to go all the way down to the Red Sea, turn there and head up to Kadesh. You maybe remember the Exodus, Kadesh Barnea, pass through that territory. These are still the 4 kings from the east with Chedorlaomer. They're ticked, and they're just conquering people. Come up through Kadesh, head up to the west side of the Dead Sea, almost up where Masada is at. Or in Gedi, right? Yeah, Masada. Come down and head towards where Sodom and Gomorrah is at. Now we're on page 4. And they're going to engage, after having defeated those other countries, or city-states, they're going to engage the 5 cities there of the 5 kings of Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, Zoar, Zeboiim. And you can see I've got some little tar pits drawn on there. That's coming up in the story. Because it says there's tar pits. I mean, there's petroleum sitting on the surface of the ground in that area of some sort, tar, the different things like this. Remember, just in passing, Sodom and Gomorrah is going to become, fire and brimstone is going to come down on the city. Now, when we get to that story, I just want to point this out as we get here. These cities will eventually be overcome, completely covered with fire and brimstone. Now, what that would refer to is it's going to fall on them. Now, that could be God just sending fire and brimstone out of the atmosphere. He just points his finger like Zeus, and there it goes. That can happen. But when you look at the situation right here, what would have happened potentially is some kind of an explosion, earthquake explosion, all the gases that are in there, there would have been some kind of an explosion blowing the same stuff that's sitting on the ground right here in the story that's going to cover the city later, which would have been an explosion up and a falling out down. And so there would have been the explosion, and they would have just been covered up with the stuff that came up out of the ground. You don't have to, not dogmatic, but that would explain how logical and how real the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is. It's not a fairy tale. It actually happened. And that's how it would have actually took place. It's all set up for that. And possibly even the explosion that stuffed up and coming down would have dropped down the land. Sodom and Gomorrah would have settled down. The water of the Dead Sea would have settled over them. They would be buried right there and under the Dead Sea. People are still trying to figure out. Today, south of the Dead Sea right there, there are still tar types of substance just floating in the Dead Sea. It's still coming up. It's still there. So this is exactly the right location. But nonetheless, those kings conquer those people. Some people are going to go hide in the tar pits. And then, of course, that jagged line, whatever you look at it there, heads up north towards Damascus. Turn to page 5. They pass through Dan, Damascus. Actually, that line should go up through the city of Dan. Through Damascus, up to the place where Hobah is at. They're heading back east. They're going home. They've had everything they need. They got everybody conquered. And at that point, guess what? One of those people at Sodom and Gomorrah escapes and goes over and tells Abram, "We've been conquered, and Lot's been taken." At which point I would say, that's a shame. I wish he could have made some better decisions in his life. But Abram, turn the page. You can see on that page 4, map 4, you can see Abram is over there in Hebron. And there's the great tree of Mamre, the Amorite there. I mean, that's where his property, and Abram is camped out there in his property with all of his people. Abram instead heads up north to Dan, going through Damascus, and meets the king of Chedorlaomer and the three other eastern kings, engages them in a nighttime battle, conquers them, and brings back all the plunder. And on this map right here, you can see him coming down the last map, map 6, coming past the city of Salem, through the valley of, it says, Sheveh, or which would we call the valley of Kidron, or the Kidron Valley, the valley of the kings, and heading back home. And that's our story. Those maps, you can kind of use those if you want to kind of keep up with it. All right, we are in Genesis chapter 14. So far, I've given you the moral lessons of chapter 14. I've given you the maps of chapter 14. Now we're going to read chapter 14. And then we're going to draw. I have a little, you know, game, charade. What am I drawing? Guess what it is? Stick man, Abraham. Yep. Chapter 14, verse 1. At this time, Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Eleazar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goyim, went to war against, and now here's the five kings of Sodom and Gomorrah's area, Bera, king of Sodom, you could call it the Pentapolis of southern, south of the Dead Sea, Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Sinab, king of Adma, Semeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. Now, right here, we look at, just for example, you see Semeber, king of Zeboim. You can see two names right there. You can see Shem and Eber, Shem-Eber. And that would be a combination of two patriarchal names of even the lineage of Abram there coming together. That would mean, you know, Shem is great. Also, you can see the first name, Bera. His name is connected with the word evil. It means to do evil. His name is in evil, or it means in evil. Yeah, just like that. And the next one is in means after Bera. The next one, Bersha, is a word that means to do wickedness, and it would mean in wickedness. So nonetheless, you've got those meanings right there. So even their names indicate some kind of corruption. Why were the four kings from the east coming out to do battle against the five kings? The next verse. All these later kings joined forces in the valley of Siddim, that's the area just south of the Dead Sea, the Salt Sea. For 12 years, they, the kings in the area of Siddim, or Sodom, they had been subject to Chedorlaomer. But in the 13th year, they rebelled. So in other words, for 12 years, they had been sending some kind of financial tribute over to Chedorlaomer. They had been conquered 12 years ago. They had been now under foreign occupation for 12 years. They'd suffered a famine. After the famine, they'd been occupied now for 12 years by a foreign power. And in that year, they decided, you know what? We're going to rebel. We're not going to be under the influence of foreign powers any longer. Now, if you are going to rebel against a foreign power, you need to make sure God is on your side. In this case, God is not on their side. The foreign power has been placed there by God. And so their rebellion against the foreign power is rebellion against what God is doing to their culture, and it's not going to work. We see the same thing take place in Samaria when they rebelled against the Assyrians. We see the same thing take place in Jerusalem in 586, or up leading up to that time. A couple times the kings rebelled against the Babylonians, brought the wrath of the Babylonians. We see the same thing take place in 66 AD when the Jews, the Zealots, rebel against the Romans and brought about the wrath. The Assyrians, the Babylonians, and the Romans all brought wrath on the Jews when they decided they're going to rebel against the foreign power that God had put on them. Well, here they're going to rebel, and they did. They rebelled in the 12th year. It took Chedorlaomer about a year. They had to wait for the season. You know, you got to wait for the right season in March. You can't just fight year-round. There's a season in the spring when the kings go to war. It's when David would go to war. They got everything organized. He gets three allies with him from the east, and they march over, and here they come. They're coming to collect their tribute. It says right here, for the 12th year they'd been subject. In the 13th year they failed to pay the tribute. So in verse 5, in the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings allied with him went out and defeated. Now we're coming down the Transjordan side, or that east side of the Jordan, coming down the king's highway. And we're going to list some names right here, and I could go show you the Deuteronomy verses. The names of these people, you may be familiar with them. They defeated the Rephaites in Ashtaroth, Karnim, the Zuzites in Ham, the Emites in Shavah, Karathaim, and the Horites in the hill country of Seir. That's now down into Edom, down south of Sodom and Gomorrah, right down like my map showed you. Those peoples that are named right there in Deuteronomy are all described in two different places as being large people, of a large stature. They are the ones that are recognized as being giants. These, if you go with that Nephilim story, these may be some remnants of that group that is still left on there. Either way, these people are a mighty people. They're a large people. There are people that are terrifying. But the kings from the east, now watch, they're setting the stage. The kings of the east just march right through them, destroying them, taking their plunder. They go right past Sodom and Gomorrah, circle around the south. Sodom and Gomorrah trying to figure out, what are we going to do? They go down into Edom, and it continues here. Then they turn back and went to En-Mishpat, that is Kadesh. That's, again, where Moses spent a lot of time in the wilderness, Kadesh Barnea. And they conquered the whole territory of the Amalekites. That's the people that are south of Judah. Remember, the Amalekites fought with Moses a couple of times. And eventually, Saul went down there and fought them, and finally David eliminated them. The Amalekites, as well as the Amorites that were living in Hazazon Tamar, which is again up on the west side of the Dead Sea, as you can see on the map. So they've made that full circle, come up, and now they're going to move in on Sodom and Gomorrah. We don't get any details of the battle. It just tells them this is where they've been, this is who they've conquered, and here we go. Verse 8. Then the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboiim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, marched out and drew up their battle lines in the valley of Siddim against Chedorlaomer, king of Elam. And it gives you the five kings, or four kings again. Now notice, they saw him coming on the coming down the Transjordan. They saw him circle around down through Edom. They saw him come up through Kadesh Barnea, and they're just conquering everybody. And now they're trapped. They're encircled. And at this point they say, we better drop our battle lines. They're hoping maybe they just keep right on going to Egypt. They're hoping something will happen, but they got to know that they're in trouble. They didn't pay their tribute. They wait for the last minute. You can think about maybe some better ideas here. Maybe like going out and meeting them earlier, engaging them earlier instead of letting them build up their forces. But nonetheless, they're trapped. There's not like, well, these guys are great people. You think, well, they went out and marched out and drew up their battle lines. That's their last option. I mean, what next stop is just sit here and wait for them to come and take your house. So there's nowhere to go except the battle line. And you're going to see the battle line collapse. You're all going to flee. I mean, these people are not going to fight a battle. They're not ready to fight a battle. Well, let's watch right here. I mean, just think about their culture. Their culture is corrupt. Their culture is soft. They're drawing up battle lines with no intention of fighting this battle. In fact, the king of Sodom himself is going to be one of the first ones to flee. Well, anyway, it tells you there in verse 9, against Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goyim, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Eleazar. Four kings against five. Now, the valley of Siddim, that's the area of Sodom, was full of tar pits. And when the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, I mean, that's your battle information. They drew up their battle lines and fled. That's their battle plan. We're going to draw up our battle lines, and if they engage us in battle, I'm heading for the tar pits. Are you? Yeah, I'm heading for the tar pits. And they apparently, it says right here, they fled. Some of the men fell into them, and the rest fled to the hills. Now, the word fell can mean just that. They're running, and fall, splash, or stick into a tar pit. And then you can imagine there you got the guys struggling in the tar pit trying, y'all getting all gummy and sticky, which is a horrifying thought. But the word also means to settle or to hide. It means to flee to. That word right there, when it says they fell into, the word fell can mean they went down there to hide. It doesn't necessarily mean they fell. The same word is used of descending off of a camel. Rebecca, the same word, got down off her camel. And they didn't translate it. Rebecca, upon seeing Isaac, fell off her camel. Okay. Now, that would be very romantic. I mean, that might happen to some of us when the ladies see us. But she didn't fall. She descended from the camel. And so the same thing here. It can mean they and fell into the pit. But it can mean more like their battle plan was to draw up the battle lines and then flee and hide in the tar pits. And so it doesn't mean on their way to the hills, some fell into the tar pits, but some made it to the hills. But they had their own place where they're going to go hide. And again, I'm not saying it's right or wrong. It just gives you an idea of what's going on there. It says, when the kings of Sodom of Gomorrah fled, some of the men... Now notice, who fled? The kings fled first, and the men go, what? And they go, we got to get out of here. There's no direction. The first ones to leave were the leaders. The first ones to give up the battle were those who were the ones that were supposed to be defending and leading the people. The king of Sodom, now watch, just make a comparison between Abram, who's completely out of the picture, just said, well, you get what you deserve, who actually now takes a stand and goes and does something to help the people, or the kings of these people who realize, we're not going to win this. We're in trouble. They flee, and so the men flee, and some of them fled to or fell into the tar pits. The rest of them then fled to the hills. They're just scattering. The four kings from the east seized all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, all the cattle, all the gold, all the VCRs and television sets. They took everything they could from the city and all their food, which was very valuable. And they went away, meaning they're going home. They marched right now, going right back up the King's Highway, going back north, going to pass through Dan, Damascus, and on into Mesopotamia. They also, just a note here, they also carried off Abram's nephew Lot and his possessions, since he was living in Sodom. There's your first indication. From last time we saw him, as we ended chapter 15, moved towards Sodom. But when this came, he was taken captive because he was living in Sodom. And notice right here, his possessions. Now he has nothing. And he now gets a place where he's a slave or a captive. All of his possessions are in the hands of the people of the east. He has nothing. But for Abraham, once again, intervening into his life, getting all of his stuff back, giving him his freedom and his life back, he chooses to go back to Sodom. He gets to start again. But if it wasn't for Abram, that would be the end of Lot. It took you 14 verses to go from being so wealthy, living by Abram, that you've got to separate because your workers are arguing. You've got to separate. Your wealth is so great. So he moves towards Sodom, moves into Sodom, and in 14 verses has nothing. Zippo. He's lost his freedom. He's lost his possessions. He is now a captive. And if it wasn't for Abram coming up and helping him and restoring him, he would die as a captive over in the east somewhere. Verse 13. One who had escaped came and reported to Abram the Hebrew. Interesting here, he is called a Hebrew. Hebrew is, again, from the word Eber, one of Abram's descendants, forefathers. Eber, and so he was a descendant of Eber, or this is an ethnic term for him. You are a descendant of Eber or a Hebrew, in comparison to what we're going to be getting right here, some other men that are Amorites. In other words, Abram the Hebrew is living among the Canaanites, and he is known as Abram the Hebrew. He's the foreigner living among us. He has great influence on him, but but he is a foreigner living among them. The word Hebrew is used like five times. An Egyptian says Hebrew or calls him Hebrews. Five times the Philistines call him Hebrew. I think it's like eight times the editors that are writing the narrators use the word Hebrew. And it is most likely used as an ethnic term saying this is this group of people. So keep that in mind. One who had escaped came and reported this to Abram the Hebrew. Now Abram was living near the great trees of Mamre. And you can see on your maps where that's at. Mamre is it's near Hebron. It's about halfway down the Dead Sea to the west. Came and reported he was living near the great trees of Mamre, and Mamre was an Amorite, one of the Canaanite living there, a brother of Eshcol and Aner. And those three men, Mamre, Eshcol, and Aner, just like Chedorlaomer had his three kings that came with him, or his three partners that came, allies that came, these are going to be Abram's three allies. And you must realize, these three allies, Mamre, Eshcol, and Aner, are most likely believers. They're not worshiping the Canaanite gods. They are probably of the same faith of Abraham, maybe having been influenced by him. Melchizedek, we're going to find out, is a believer. My point is, in the land of Canaan, there were believers in the land of Canaan, believers in the God that Abraham worshipped. He's in treaty with them. All who were allied with Abram. Again, remember how he's going to treat the king of Sodom. I don't want anything to do with you. But these guys, he's an ally. When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, when he heard that his family, when he heard that someone that was in covenant with him had been taken captive, he's got to respond. And this is amazing right here. This right here helps explain, gives you an indication of who Abram was. Watch this next part. When he heard his relative had been taken captive, he called out 318 trained men born in his household. Now, 318 is a good size number. Pretty specific, 318. Meaning this is not the stuff of legends. 318 means we counted them, 318, write it down. It's documented. Trained men, it means militarily trained. These are not shepherds who grabbed a stick and went to war with Abram. These are not people that are watching his sheep and cattle. These are military retainers. These are men who have been brought into Abram's household, servants or slaves. They are part of his household, part of his community that he is the head of, and their job is to retain and protect his stuff. They're on staff. They don't watch sheep. They protect the sheep. They're not shepherds. They protect the shepherds. And when Lot's stuff is taken captive by these three kings, he calls out. The word called out is poured out. It can also be poured out. He lets loose his military and says, leave the stuff. We're going after. There's no danger here anymore. Everybody's conquered. Let's go get the stuff. Let's go get Lot. Let's go defend these people. The culture itself collapsed. Now, if you want just a little, make an application of this. The culture itself could not defend itself. It took someone like Abram, who had the resources, not just in material things, but had the moral and the capacity to go out and do this thing to save his culture. Now, if you want to make an application, there you go. You're a Christian. You may not have 318 trained soldiers, but you do have the Word of God. You do have your own life. You do have your own calling that God has given you. You can make a difference. One man, Abram, went out and made an impact and changed that culture. Saved that culture. Gave him another chance. They didn't use it. They're destroyed here in the next couple chapters. But Abram made a difference. All hope is gone but for Abram and his household. And he engaged. He didn't go, well, there's nothing I can do. He goes, well, sure is something I can do. He takes his 318 trained military retainers, men born in his household, that does not mean descendants of his or family members, but in his household, in his community as a sheikh, these are his people, men born in his household who went in pursuit as far as Dan. You can see on your map, Dan is just north of the Sea of Galilee. He's going to intervene. He's going to connect with them as they're going north. He's going to travel 125 miles with these 318 trained men, maybe Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, and someone's coming with them. Maybe they brought something along. And went in pursuit as far as Dan. Here's the battle plan. First night battle recorded in history. Now, there's probably had been others, but this is the first recording, the oldest recording of a night battle. During the night, Abram divided his men to attack them, maybe into three. We see other places in the Bible where they divided them into three groups, three camps. Gideon does that, puts them in three. He has another night invasion with three groups. It doesn't tell us how many. During the night, Abram divided his men to attack them and routed them, pursuing them as far as Hobah. And you can see on the map, he had traveled 125 miles, divides his men, waits for the night, invades these four kings from the east. This is Iran and Iraq, that area. He invades the powerful kings of the east, routs them in the night, and chases them out of the country. These kings had already defeated several city-states coming down. During the night, Abram divided his men to attack them and routed them, pursuing them as far as Hobah, north of Damascus. He recovered all the goods. The kings of the east didn't have time to even pack some away. Just like when David went down and conquered the Amalekites after they'd burnt his city of Ziklag, he went down and found them in a huge party. That may give some credence, but maybe that's what they were doing. A night attack, they're probably defeated everybody, they're on their way back, they're probably celebrating. It doesn't say that. But they didn't. They scattered so fast, they didn't even collect anything. They just ran for their lives. They escaped with their lives. Now realize they're probably mad. Realize that they've just been humiliated by Abram. They've defeated everybody in that area except one man. Chances are they'll come back to get him, you would think. He recovered all the goods and brought back his relative Lot and his possessions, together with the women and the other people. Now notice again, Lot is going to be restored because of what Abram did. Verse 17, after Abram returned from defeating Chedorlaomer and the kings allied with him. Now that, you understand what that says? When Abram, the man, returned from defeating Iran and Iraq, he returned. I mean, that's, the man went over there and did it with his people. Chedorlaomer and the kings allied with him. The king of Sodom came out to meet him in the valley of Sheveh, that is the king's valley. Now, this is the situation here. I wanted to do this real quickly. There is the city of Salem right here. Okay, there we go. Not much of a city, but there it is. This is going to become Jerusalem. There is a valley coming down on this side of this city, a valley. It's called the Kidron Valley. That's what we call it today. There's a mount, all this. This is Mount Olive right here. I'll just write M-O, Mount Olive. Mount of Olive right over here. Coming down on this side, there's a little valley, a central valley that comes down here and connects. And on this side is the Hinnom Valley coming across like this. This is the city of Salem. It's a smaller city. If you find your Bible maps, you find it's almost like a footprint right here. This is Mount Moriah right up here. Mount Moriah is a mound. Mount Zion is over here, another mound. In other words, this is a valley. Here's a valley. Here, this is Central Valley. This is the Hinnom Valley. And these are rugged valleys. They're not like, you know, though I pass through the valley, you know, it's a green grass with a little, they're rocky. In fact, that is why, see this right here? This is a rock formation coming up out of the ground. It's naturally defended on this side, on the south side, and the west side here, just by surely, if you look up at it, you've got to climb it. I mean, it's a rock from here. Then they put a wall up on top of that, so you've got to crawl up out of the valley. When you get out of the valley, you've now got to scale the wall. And this is the city of Salem in our story today. Real quickly, when you go through this, the Bible, you're going to see in Joshua, Judges, even in 1 Samuel, this is going to be the city of the Jebusites. It's going to be called Jabesh, J-E-B-U-S, Jabesh. It is eventually going to be called Jerusalem. That's the city, but it's called Salem at this time. It's easy to defend. The Jebusites in David's day mock him and say, you can't take this city. Even the blind and the lame could defend this city. And they're right, because you're up on top of a very rugged area. Only one place to invade this would be right here on the north side. And that's where they'd build their fortresses, their palaces. This is where they defend this part of the city. You can't get up anywhere else. Mount Moriah is a mound just north of it right here, just real close to it. This is where Abram, eventually, I'm just showing this. This is where Abram is going to be told by God. He says, I'll show you the place I want Isaac offered. He's going to leave Hebron, walk 3 days up to Moriah. In David's day, David's going to conquer the city of Salem or Jerusalem. Solomon is going to build the walls up and extend it around this Mount Moriah area, and Jerusalem's going to be this big, with the temple being built right here on Mount Moriah. Eventually, the city's going to grow to the west. By the time you get to Hezekiah's day, 700 BC, the city's going to grow over here to the west. The central valley is going to be filled in, and eventually this is going to become the city of Jerusalem, say like in David's time, or excuse Jesus' time. The point right here. They're coming back. Let's get rid of this line right here. We got our valleys. Just so you know, Abram is coming back down through this valley area. These valleys meet right here. The Central Valley, the Kidron Valley, the Hinnom Valley meet right here, and then they run down as a valley down to the Dead Sea down here. Abram is traveling back on this side, heading down here to Hebron where he's going home. As he goes by Salem, okay, right here, we are now in verse 17. After Abram returned from defeating Chedorlaomer and the kings allied with him, the king of Sodom, the one who collapsed and fled from the military, he's alive. He wasn't taken captive. Came out to meet him in the valley of Shaveh, that is the King's Valley or the Kidron Valley. Most likely this place of meeting is right here. This is where Abram's on his way by. King of Sodom comes up to meet him. And he says right here, we go on. After the king of Sodom comes out, someone else comes out. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of God Most High and blessed Abram. I want you to see this very quickly. You've got the guy Melchizedek. And I'm just going to write this, Zedek. All right? Melchizedek. The name Zedek means just. Melchi. His name is Melchizedek. Melchi means I just forgot. God is just. Let me look at my notes. I knew right before I stopped there, I knew what it said. So, Hebrews tells you. Melchizedek means king. So there we go. Hebrews are king. The just king, or the king of Salem. So king of justice. I want to show you this real quickly. Go to Joshua. Joshua chapter 11. And Joshua is going to come by later and defeat this area when Joshua enters the land in the central campaign. Joshua chapter 11. No. Chapter 10. Now, just stay with me. Are you ready? This is trivial, probably, but I like it. Chapter 10, verse 1. Joshua now is going to engage the central campaign. He's defeated Jericho. He's had the problem at Ai, and now they're into the central campaign. And this is when the sun stands still. Chapter 10, verse 1. Notice right here. Now, Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard that Joshua had taken Ai and totally destroyed it. Doing to Ai and the king as he had done to Jericho. Goes through there, and you can see it down there in verse 3. So Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, appeared to all the other kings, the king of Hebron, Lachish, Eglon, all these, and said, hey, we've got to unite against Joshua. But notice who is king of Jerusalem in Joshua's day. 600 years later, the king is Adonai Zedek. You understand what I'm saying? This Zedek was the family name. And he was a Jebusite or an Amorite. In Abraham's day, 2000 BC, Melchizedek was a believer. Came out and blessed Abram. He was a Jebusite. He was a Canaanite. But he was a believer. 600 years later, a descendant, or at least with the same family name, Adonai Zedek, comes out to fight against Joshua and is overthrown. He is killed. Adonai Zedek is killed by Joshua. The city of Salem is never taken. The Israelites come in and conquer the whole land, live around this, but they never take the city of Salem. They can't. No one can conquer Salem. No one can conquer Jerusalem. Not until David's day, around 1000 B.C., does David, right here on this side, right here in the Kidron Valley, there's a water source called the Gihon Springs. You can see it. I was there. Water's still coming from there. You can drink from it if you want to. Don't, but you could. I walked in it. The Gihon Springs right here, they had it just on the edge of the wall. They had come down in a tunnel to get the water and go back up into the city. David told his men, told Joab his general, no one's going to take that city. Since Joshua, we've tried for 400 years to conquer Salem. If you're going to conquer it, you've got to go through the water system. So they shimmied up through the water system and led the army in, kind of like the city of Troy, probably opened the gates or something, but they invaded from the inside. The Jebusites were taken in 1000 B.C. by David, and that ended any kind of line of the Zadokites. But we're back in 2000 B.C. with Melchizedek. To go back to Genesis, please. Genesis 14. Melchizedek comes out, and he is a believer, and he's got the right perspective. He is going, several things are taking place in the story. You can read about it in Hebrews as they make a connection to this. Melchizedek is called a priest of God Most High. He was a priest of Abraham's God. This was before, of course, the Israelites, as far as being a nation and a Sinai, before they established that priesthood of Levi. He is a priest of God Most High. He is a believer. And he comes out here, it says in verse 18, then Melchizedek, king of Salem, or king of justice, brought out bread and wine. Now, you can get excited about bread and wine, and maybe you should, because we just had communion this morning, and here it is, he's bringing communion out. That's a stretch. It's real hard to make that connection. I mean, it is easy when you read the book of John and Matthew and you read back into it. But when you read other accounts, like if you read in Joshua or Judges, they would bring, in the book of Judges, a guy comes through the city of Jerusalem and says, hey, can I stay with you? I've got fodder for my donkey and we've got bread and wine for ourselves. In other words, what bread and wine mean here in this context is simply Melchizedek comes out and says, Abram, eat with me. In other words, Melchizedek is the 10th king of the story. The 10th king. He had 4 kings from the east, 5 kings from the west. They fight. Abram comes up, defeats him, and returns. And the 10th king comes out and says, you are God's man. May God bless you. He was a believer. The 10th king comes out. And what the 10th king does to Abram is offer him a standing in the community. As guess what, I would say, as a king. He says, come eat with me, we'll recognize you as a king. In fact, if you go please, if you would, let me find it real quickly. Go to, yes, chapter 23 of Genesis. Chapter 3 of Genesis. Sarah has died. And Abram has no property, but he wants a place to bury Sarah. He's going to buy a cave from one of his allies, the cave of Machpelah, from a Hittite. Chapter 23, verse 3, and Abraham rose from beside his dead wife and spoke to the Hittites. He said, I am an alien and a stranger among you. Meaning he never bought any land, he never settled down, never joined their culture. He's an identity unto himself. Defended the country, but he's an identity unto himself. I'm an alien and stranger among you. Sell me some property for a burial site here so I can bury my dead. Sarah has just died. Verse 5. The Hittites replied to Abram. This is what the Hittites said to Abram. Sir, listen to us. You are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choices of our tombs. None of us refuse you his tomb for burying your dead. What do you want? We will give it to you. The key, what do they recognize Abram has? Right here, a prince. You are a prince. You are royalty. You are now an identity of your own. Where do you want you put your dead? In other words, when Melchizedek comes out, he reckoned with the bread and the wine and comes out and blesses him, he recognizing Abram on the standing of a king. He's got to. The kings of the east have defeated the kings of the west. There's no kings left. Of course, the king of Sodom's there. Abram has now conquered the... He now controls the people of all these cities. He controls the wealth of all these cities. Melchizedek simply comes out and says, bread and wine. Come eat with me. You're now in the family. You're in the royalty. You are now a king. It goes on. It's more than that. He's got the right perspective. He was, goes on. I'm going to read verse 18 again. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abram, saying, and here's a very impressive blessing. Blessed be Abram by God Most High. Notice he's already recognizing the Abrahamic covenant. No man can do this. You can't just go to war against Iraq and Iran with some of your own trained men. You're blessed by God Most High. You are walking in a covenant with God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, helping to identify who he is. Again, Melchizedek, I believe, was a believer in the God that Abraham believed in, the God that appeared to Abram in the land of Ur of the Chaldeans, the God of glory. But their understanding, their revelation is, of course, it's not at the level of Paul in the New Testament. But they recognize him as the creator of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand. Just in passing, the word delivered is the word for shield. He was your shield when you went to battle, who delivered your enemies into your hands. If you flip over to chapter 15, verse 1, after these events that we're talking about right now today, well, we'll get this next week, chapter 15, verse 1, after this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid. I am your shield, your very great reward. Why would Abram be afraid? Why would he say, Abram, all of a sudden, chapter 15, Abram, don't be afraid. Well, he's just defeated Iran and Iraq. It's like he's just crushed those people. It's like they are coming back. Don't be afraid. Then he says, I am your shield, using the same form of the word that Melchizedek has used. I am still your deliverer. And Abram has just given up all the wealth of all the surrounding communities. And God says, and I am your great reward. It's not this material stuff. You've got the right perspective. I will defend you, and I will be your reward. Don't start trying to defend yourself with alliances with these corrupt cultures, and don't start thinking all their possessions are your wealth. If you start thinking your strength is in alliances with people and your reward is their wealth, you're now the king of Sodom. Melchizedek comes out and says, Abram, I recognize this. You have been shielded by God. God is your reward. And God is going to repeat the same thing to him. Let's go back and look in chapter 14 and finish this up. Blessed be Abram, the God Most High, creator of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand. Then Abram gave a tenth of everything. Melchizedek comes out and recognizes him as an equal, maybe even royalty. You are the king. God has blessed you. You control everything. He recognizes him. Melchizedek comes out here in the Valley of the Kings and recognizes Abram. Abram then turns and recognizes Melchizedek and gave him a tenth of everything. Melchizedek honored God by recognizing God's man, Abram. Abram honors God by recognizing God's priest in Salem and gave him a tenth. The tenth was, of course, we call it the tithe. In that case, it was the king's portion. It was the king's portion of the plunder. This is the, they got a tenth of the crop, they got a tenth of this, they got a tenth. Here's the tenth, the king's plunder. He honors Melchizedek and the God of Melchizedek by giving him a tenth of the plunder. Now, that's all good. Verse 21. The king of Sodom said to Abram, you're giving away stuff. In other words, what you just saw here was an agreement. The king of Salem came out and met Abram, and Abram met him. They had an agreement. They're in agreement in their faith. They're in agreement with their priorities. They're in agreement with the Abrahamic covenant, and they're going to go on their way as allies, along with Mamre, Aner, and Eshcol. But the king of Sodom said to Abram, okay, here's my deal. Give me the people and keep the goods for yourself. That was the typical covenant of a situation like this. If a group of people came in or a man came in and delivered a community, the stuff he delivered was his, but the community got their freedom and the king got his position as king. He continued to get to be the ruler and would, in a sense, be the ruler of the person that delivered him. You understand what I'm saying? If someone in the community came out and delivered the nation, that doesn't mean he's above the nation. That means he gets the plunder from the nation, but he remains as a subject of the nation he helped deliver. And basically, King of Sodom basically says this to Abram. I'll remain my position as king. You will continue in my kingdom. But as a reward for delivering our kingdom, I'll let you keep all the possessions. Now, is Abram going to go with that? Is Abram going to say, yes, thank you very much. I recognize you as my king and I'm going to be subject to you. He knows enough not to be sold out to materialism, and he knows enough not to get involved in an alliance that is not substantial, not has no substance to it. Give me the people. I'll remain my kingship, and you keep all the goods for yourself as a reward from me, your king. But Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have raised my hand to the Lord, God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and have taken an oath that I'll accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or a thong of the sandal, so that you will never be able to say that I made Abram rich. He could be referring to the event that just took place between him and Melchizedek, where he's raised his hand, a typical place of taking a vow, would raise his right hand and took the vow. Or he could be referring to where he'd built the altar before. Remember up there between Ai and Bethel, he'd built the altar and been there a couple of times. When he came up out of Egypt, we saw last week, and he went back there and restored his relationship with God. He may have at that time says, I'm never going to break this relationship again. I'm not going to break fellowship. I make a vow. I'm not going to get sold out of this society. He might have made it there. But at this point right here, when the king of Sodom makes an offer, he says to him, I have raised my hand to the Lord God Most High, using the same terminology as Melchizedek, creator of heaven and earth, same terminology, and I have taken an oath. I am a man that has taken an oath before God Most High, that I will accept nothing belonging to you. I want none of this material possessions of yours. I'm not going to come into agreement with you. I'm not going to be aligned with your values. I'm not going to be aligned with your prosperity. I'm living from another system. Not even a thread or a thong of a sandal. And that sometimes in other ancient writings it would say a thread like for clothing or a straw referring to the grass of the land. I don't even want a thread or the grass. In this case, the clothing and the sandal. I don't even want a thread, the smallest piece of clothing from you, or the smallest piece of a sandal, the string or the latch, the shoestring basically. I don't want anything. I don't even want you giving me a drink of water. Because I don't want you ever to be able to say, I made Abram rich. The reason Abram was rich is he sold out to the ways of the world. I don't want it ever says, I was rich because I sold out to the king of Sodom. He said, I want you to realize, I'm going to be rich. I'm going to be successful because I'm walking in God's ways. I will accept nothing. Notice this again. I mentioned this earlier tonight, this morning. I will accept nothing but what my men have eaten and the share that belongs to the men who went with me to Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Myself, I've made a vow. I'm walking with God. But my men, they deserve their portion. And my allies that went with me, you better give them their portion. They'll choose first. But I am turning my back and walking away from you and realize you have no authority in my life. I have nothing to do with you. You can never say I'm in agreement with Lot or Abram. In fact, he said, I didn't even come fight for you. I will accept nothing but what my men have eaten and what their share belongs to the men who went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them have their share. And that is the account of Abram defeating the kings and how he, again, at the end of that chapter, you see him making an alliance or an agreement with Melchizedek, a believer, someone who's got the right perspective, who offered him right standing with himself and with God, welcomed him into his presence. Abraham received that, received the blessing, recognized the Abrahamic covenant. And then again, he himself recognized Melchizedek, says, I recognize you as a believer. There's an agreement. They work together. But when the king of Sodom came out and says, hey, you know, hey, we got to all work together on this. I'll let you have part of my goods. You have, give me the kingdom. He said, I'm not coming this way. Look what it's done to Lot. I'm going to walk with God and stay in God's ways. The last thing we just mentioned is we make the simple applications to our own lives. We've got a culture that's in trouble. We've got a culture that's being overrun by all kinds of things. We can stand back and watch, or we can engage the battle like Abram did, not physically, not going to war with somebody, but we can engage with our resource that we've got to try and bring the people back. But in doing so, we got to make sure there's a line of division. Those that are allied on God's side, that are working for God, that have got the right priorities, that's your strength, that's your resources. But at the same time, there's the other side, the ways of the world, the culture, that somehow want to use us or use our advantage or use our position. It's like, no, we're not in agreement with that. Our strength, our guidance, our deliverance comes from God Most High. We don't need to compromise. We'll ally with those that are on the same side, but we will not compromise to get on the side of some. They're going to promise us, well, we can give you something. It's like, we don't need it. We don't even need a shoestring. We don't need a blade of grass. We will trust God. We will not come into an unholy alliance to get something to give us some kind of a benefit. Abraham says, not so. I'll trust God. And he stayed in that Abrahamic covenant, and God, of course, is going to continue to bless him and prosper. One of the great chapters of Abraham's life. Abraham's life is laid out for us. We see him high, we see him low, we see him doing good things, we see him doing crazy things, sinful things. But this was a chapter where he had the right perspective, he did the right thing, and he came out on top. We'll continue with this next week, chapter 15. Father, do thank you again for your truth. We thank you for your word. We thank you for the biblical examples. Father, do ask that we might have the strength to be like Abraham, to choose righteousness, to know when to move and when to act, and to do what you've called us to. I thank you for the many resources you've provided for us, and ask that we would use them to your advantage as you would have us. And Father, I ask that we would stay away from unholy alliances, but Father, walk in agreement with those who are on the same side as you. Give us the discernment, Father, to do these things. And we do pray for our country, and ask that we might be a powerful influence at this time in our culture, this time in our history. Father, I ask again, we may be beneficial to you and to your kingdom. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.